for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Gail Caldwell writes at the outset of her new memoir, It's an Old Story. I had a friend, and we shared everything, and then she died, and so we shared that. The former Boston Globe book critic looks back on her life while remembering her best friend, Caroline Knapp, who died of lung cancer in 2002. It's the story of how an extraordinary bond between friends can endure even after death. Her new book is titled Let's Take the Long Way Home, and Gail Caldwell joins me in the studio. You are, of course, invited to join the conversation. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Gail Caldwell, congratulations to you. I understand this is going to be number 7 on the New York Times book review this coming Sunday.
Well, I think it's the Sunday after, but yes, Sunday we're after. Very pleased
you
to find that out.
You get those things very early on,
they find
don't
out,
you?
I suppose they find out about 10 days ahead of
Isn't
time,
Isn't that
yes.
something? Congratulations. Tell us about your friend, Caroline Knapp.
Oh, God, where do I get to start? We became friends in the mid-90s when we were two passionately involved women with our puppies. And that was the beginning of a long and intense and profoundly symmetrical relationship.
So you literally met over your puppies. What kind of puppy did you have?
I had a Samoyed, a beautiful white marshmallow of a dog named Clementine.
And she had?
And she had a rescue dog named Lucille, who was a German Shepherd mix.
And you were simply out walking one
well,
day?
Well, you know, we had met actually once before because we were both riders in the greater Boston area and someone had introduced us, but it was more perfunctory than pleasure, simply because we were at some bookish thing and we said hello and passed on. And then another friend who was a dog trainer said, you know, she said to me, do you know Caroline Knapp? You remind me of each other. And she was the first of many people later in our lives to say that, because I think there was something spookily similar about the two of us. And Kathy said, you should really try to get together. And then I saw Caroline probably a month later with her new puppy. And from we just went together like I started to say a couple of magnets, but a pencil to a magnet, and began a friendship that would last until she, well, beyond her death for the next 6 years,
Those
7 years.
Those friendships are so important on so many levels, not just the sharing. It is the intensity of similarities, mm-hmm. of understanding mm-hmm. that I think create the best friendships.
Yes, I think there's an intensity that I think is crucial, and also an honesty. I think that Caroline and I both had, because of our age and our experience, we had come together at a time when each of us was single, though she was in a short hiatus from her long-term relationship, and neither of us had kids. And I think that we had a very strong commitment to the friendship from the beginning. A lot of people have said to me since the book came out that they're conscious of how rare the friendship was, and I know that, and I cherish it because of it. But I think that we also knew that to last it would be work, as any friendship, as any relationship
is. Oh, boy, I should say. Yeah. Were there any differences that you did have to work through?
You mean difficulties?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Such as?
Well, I look back now, and you know, when I was writing, Caroline was such a wonderful presence for me in the writing of this book. And I would find myself romanticizing her, which of course is very easy to do after somebody is gone and you love them. And I could hear her going, oh, please, you have to tell the truth. And so we, I think about it now and I cringe to remember this. I think I'm a better friend now than I was at the beginning of our friendship, because we challenged and solved so many things for each other.
For each other.
And we were able to resolve so much together. If I were prickly or too sensitive or too snappish, or Caroline might have been the same way, and either of us could say to the other one, I'm really upset about fill in the blank. And it didn't matter if it was minor or huge. I think that each of us had the commitment to stay in the room with that sort of tension and make it okay before we moved on.
That's so important.
I think it's crucial.
That willingness to open yourself to not only your own anger or your own sadness, but someone else's at the same time.
I think that willingness, that's the key word, is the willingness to be able to hear it and accept it. And I learned a lot about that from Caroline.
You write in Let's Take the Long Way Home, which is a lovely phrase because it's one that I gather both of you used from time to time, mm-hmm, in order to extend your walks, to extend the time you enjoyed together.
That's right. That's right.
So you would take a longer route and in that time be able to flesh out what was on your mind. You write in the book that each of you had previous problems with alcohol, mm-hmm, previous problems with relationships. Did you come together out of those similarities? Would those have brought you closer together, do you think?
I'm sure they brought us closer together. I think it was serendipitous that we had those things in common after we had connected. Now, I, of course, knew about Caroline's past with alcohol because she had just written Drinking a Love Story, and I knew that she was reeling from the unexpected recognition that she got for that book. What she didn't know was that I had not had a drink in 12 years when we met, and that I had a great deal of empathy for what she had written in that book, which I shared with her a few months after our friendship began. So we came together, I think, based on the more nuanced similarities, and then turned out to have a great deal in common on a very, probably our most core sensibility was very similar.
Why do you think that dogs became such an important part of not only how you met, but your relationship and your writing in the book?
Mm. Well, it's funny. I can hear Caroline sort of smiling and thinking about this as you ask it. It's not presumptuous, I think, for me to speak for her here because she wrote about it so much in her own book. I feel that Caroline's foray into the world of dogs opened her up to love in a way that was absolutely extraordinary to her. And the same thing was happening to me in a different way, with less perhaps previous hurt involved. I had had animals in my life. I had grown up with two parents who'd grown up on farms, so I was much more familiar with animal love than when I got Clementine than Caroline was. But each of us had just fallen head over heels. And to our shock and almost dismay sometimes, you know, it's like, oh my God, what if I've just tumbled down the rabbit hole? And we understood that about each other. And I think that in a funny way that that our love for the dogs, I mean, I suppose that women might say this who bond over, who have new kids in the park and become lifelong friends. Maybe there's a way that the children expand the possibilities of the relationship. And in our sense, it became a very thick pack of four instead of pack of two, because each of us loved the other. We all four loved the other three. And when I say that, I mean her dog loved me and my dog and all the combinations thereof.
You know, it's so interesting. Not long ago, my husband and I moved into a condo, and there are other small dogs in that condo. And I had a friend there say to me the other day, I had no idea how much I was going to fall in love with my little dog. She said, I kiss his paws. I kiss him as I'm walking. I tell him how much I love him. It's extraordinary how, I mean, and I have my dog and feel the same way. Mm-hmm. So it really is extraordinary. And I think you put your finger on it when you say the dog helps you to expand your ability to love and to be generous with that love. Mm-hmm. Gail Caldwell, she's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Her new book is titled Let's Take the Long Way Home, A Memoir of Friendship. Do join us. I look forward to your calls, your comments.
Archives of The Diane Rehm Show, The Kojo Namdi Show, Metro Connection, The Animal House, and WAMU 88.5's local news stories are online at WAMU.org.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Here's our first email from Mike in Raleigh, who says, I'm a 70-year-old man who read your book this past weekend and loved it very much. I would like to think most men like me envy anyone who has had such a life-changing friendship. And, of course, we're talking now about Gail Caldwell's new book, Let's Take the Long Way Home, about her wonderful, just absolutely delightful friendship with her friend Caroline Knapp, who died of lung cancer in 2002. I would think an email like that would make you feel awfully good.
It does. It's lovely and it's very gratifying.
Read for us from the book about Caroline.
This is a little part about the beginning of our friendship. The first several months that Caroline and I knew each other come back to me with the scent of winter, the crisp, distinctively East Coast aura of snow and city streets and radiator heat. I gave her fur-lined mittens in November on her birthday. A few weeks later, we both begged off other Thanksgiving plans, then cooked a roast chicken together after a day in the woods with the dogs. The weather got worse and colder, and we adjusted our schedules accordingly. She taught me how to walk across frozen trails and sideways down steep hills, digging my feet into the terrain. I taught her the freestyle in an indoor pool, coaxing her to lay her face in the water to learn to regulate her breathing while she stood there cursing me and shivering. It seems to me now that Caroline was always cold. After the anorexia of her 20s, she had stayed on the thin side of normal, and she would show up for our walks swaddled in layers of fleece. As often as possible, we headed for the woods of the reservoir, but sometimes in the evening, when the New England sun had disappeared at an early hour, we would sneak into the Harvard athletic fields, near where I lived at the time, so that the dogs could have an open space to run. The fields backed onto a public housing project, separated by a high, dilapidated chain-link fence. Getting onto the hallowed grounds was a two-person job. One of us lifted the fence where it had come loose over a ditch, while the other rolled under it with the dogs, then held it up from the other side. Our trespass was illegal as well as rough. It was the kind of thing I had done all the time as a girl in Texas, and I was glad that Caroline was willing. For all of her exploits in the drinking world, she still possessed a good girl quality that I had never been able to muster.
Gail Caldwell reading from her new book, Let's Take the Long Way Home, a memoir of friendship. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Twitter or on Facebook. You know, as I think about friendship, you write so intensely about this friendship, not only its beginnings and its growth, it's almost a memoir of love. Mm-hmm. It goes beyond friendship, do you think?
I think friendship is love. I think that the deepest friendships are possibly as intense a relationship as we have in our lives. It just may be a different kind of love.
A different kind of love.
Well, which is to say it's not romantic or it's not contractual or... But, you know, the people I know with the longest, best marriages always say, oh, he or she is my best friend.
Yes, yes.
So I think that intimacy itself is a whole country. And, you know, sometimes it's with a four-legged creature and sometimes it's with a husband.
This is really the first time you've written about your own experience with alcohol.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
How did that begin, and how were you able to not only turn yourself around, but then begin to write about it?
Well, you mean how did the decision to write about it begin? I actually think Caroline was my moral compass for that, because I had sworn that I would never write about it. And then I began the undertaking of this book, which was... The divining rod really was my relationship with her. That's what got me headed in that direction. And then once I began, I went, oh my God, I have to write about my drinking. And I could hear her going, you can't do this and not write about your drinking. It would be dishonesty by omission.
Leaving something so important out.
And that was, I felt that it was a one-way arrow. I mean, I really had to do it. And I thought that it would be more difficult than it was. And in fact, once I began the actual writing of that part, I thought, this is a great story. You know, narrative always trumps ego or privacy, I think, when a writer is really hell-bent on something, that the story superseded whatever feelings of I might have about keeping that private.
And you also write about Caroline's anorexia.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'd learned a lot from her about anorexia. She had recovered from it with great difficulty and strength, and probably most of what I know about anorexia I learned from her.
How old was she when the anorexia became part of her life?
She was young. She was in her probably late teens. I think it was when she was at college, and she struggled through with the help of a beloved therapist who remained close to her and to me throughout her life, who I got to know when Caroline was ill, who was an expert in eating disorders. And she, I think had she once wrote that she had rode her way out of anorexia, that she learned so much to love her own body and strength that she had rode her way out of it on the Charles River. So that, too, became a great gift between us. We swapped sports, and Caroline right. taught me how to row, and I taught her how to swim. And I think that that was a beautiful stair step toward some self-regard that we both possess, that we were able to trade.
That scene of you learning to row for the first time in that narrow little boat, and you kept saying, I'm going to fall, I'm going to tumble.
Right.
And she kept saying, you're not.
That's right.
But you did.
I did, and I think she wanted me to.
And she laughed.
She laughed. Well, yeah. I was sitting in I had on a swimsuit, and we were on a lake in New Hampshire when it happened. And I actually think I was not afraid to flip, which is partly what every rower has to be willing to experience when they get in a boat that thin. And I think that Caroline wanted me to experience the beauty of rowing, but she also wanted me, as she later said, to see how hard it was. So I only made it upright for maybe three or four minutes before I went tumbling into the lake.
And she kept telling you to look straight ahead. You were
That's
looking
right.
at the water.
That's right.
And she wanted you to look at your hands and look straight ahead.
I can still hear her voice. I can hear her saying, no, you're not. She was the most sort of deadpan consolation. I can hear her saying, look at me. Look at me. Mm-hmm. And I still row. Here I am, however many
really?
Years. This is 15 years later. I can still sometimes hear her saying that, or when I get distracted on the river and I start to cast my head aside, I can remember Caroline saying, look at your hands. Look at me.
When you think about your own difficulty with alcohol,
mm-hmm.
does that go back to your family? Is there some inheritance of a problem like that?
Oh, God, yes. The number of people in my extended family. Well, I grew up in Texas, and there's a sort of whiskey myth that accompanies alcoholism. I think that probably shielded me from the truth for many years, but there are a number of people on both sides of my family who drank well and too much. And my own parents, I think it skips a generation. I did not grow up in an alcoholic family, but I certainly had numbers of people in the extended family who had died from it. So I earned it. I met my quota early, as I like to say.
How old were you when the problem with addiction began?
Well, I was 14 when I took my first drink, and I think I had a problem but didn't know it. I thought, this is great. This can make life really worth living. And I later understood that. And, you know, I don't think I was a necessarily unhappy child. I was a shy, kind of a bookworm. I had a big old glass of bourbon and the world lit up, and I thought, I can do life if I have this in my hand. So I think probably most people who drink don't feel that way, that strongly and immediately. And it was to become my accompaniment for the next 18, 19 years. And of course, as is always the case with alcohol, there's the old story about first the drink takes the drink, and then the drink takes the man.
Mm.
And obviously substitute woman for that, because it gets all of us. It tried to take me too. And so it was almost 20 years before I was able to crawl out of that cell.
Caroline's personality was also mm-hmm. an addictive one.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to the anorexia
mm-hmm.
and to the alcoholism, do you think that that's part of what drew the two of you so closely together?
I absolutely think the understanding that we had each achieved from dealing with the dark loneliness of those struggles was part of what brought us together. I think that each of us would have argued in different ways whether you know, it's do genes beget personality or vice versa? Mm. We each had a number of reasons in our past, be they genetic or environmental, that put us in those places. And I learned from her that anorexia was an addiction, which I did not understand, I think, until we became friends. But I think it was the strength that I knew that I had seen and would see Caroline exhibit, the extraordinary strength of character, and the compassion that probably each of us had earned from what we had been through was central to our friendship.
Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Gail Caldwell, her new book, Let's Take the Long Way Home, will be number 7 on the New York Times bestseller list on September the 12th. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Tell me how Caroline found out she was sick and how she related that to you.
Oh, God. Unfortunately, she did not have to relate it to me. I was there when the doctor came out of the surgery where they had done a bronchoscopy. Caroline had been ill throughout a bad New England winter, and she was 42 years old, and we thought that she had
pneumonia. Or something of that sort.
Yeah, a bronchitis that would not go away. And they finally, after weeks of antibiotics and efforts to cure the pneumonia, did a bronchoscopy and found what turned out to be inoperable tumor on her lung. And I was in the surgical recovery room when the doctor came out and described the tumor, described it as necrotic and inoperable, words that no one ever wants to hear. And I still remember the light in the room. I don't know why this happens. There's something, light gets brighter in the midst of horrendous, life-changing news. And so by the time, then I was with Caroline in the elevator going back to her room. So that was in April, and she was gone by early June.
Wow.
7 weeks.
That's extraordinary.
Stunning. I think that everybody who loved her was reeling for a year just by the fact of how swiftly we went from a cough to a memorial service.
And the idea that perhaps there were many other friends in that circle who knew her well enough to grieve.
Mm. Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that. I got a letter actually yesterday from someone who I know peripherally but not well, and she had written to say something about the book, and she said something about the way she had seen us together at the pond over the years, and she said, and I was one of the hundreds of people at her service at Mount Auburn that day. And I think that one of the things that still makes me happy and sad at the same time is remembering how many people loved her, because I think Caroline had this extraordinary ability to connect with people through her writing as well as personally.
And so I gather she spent most of her last weeks in the hospital.
She spent some of, let's see, I think she probably spent 3 weeks in the hospital and then was in chemo and radiation and went home for a while. And then a series of mishaps a constellation of bad symptoms began, and she went back to the hospital in mid-May and would never leave.
A constellation of bad
symptoms. Well, she had what began as a series of bleeds in the brain. And so she married her longtime boyfriend and relationship, Mark Morelli, in early May. And then I had to fly to Austin, Texas. And while I was gone, I found out that this had happened. And that was in mid-May. And she had gone to the hospital by ambulance, and that was three weeks before she died. Mm.
So I gather you were with her at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Very tough. Gail Caldwell. And we're talking about her brand new book. It's titled, Let's Take the Long Way Home.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
If you've got an old car, truck, motorcycle, or boat that you'd like to clear out, let the WAMU 88.5 Vehicle Donation Program help. Call 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org.
Welcome back, and if you've just joined us, Gail Caldwell is telling the beautiful story of her friendship with a woman who died of lung cancer at age 44.
42.
Her book is titled, Let's Take the Long Way Home. Let's go first to Amy, who's in Exeter, New Hampshire. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Certainly.
Gail, this is one of the most beautiful books I've ever read.
Oh, my God. Thank you.
I cried throughout and read it literally in one day. And just as an aside, I ordered it electronically, and I loved it so much I bought it in hardcover. I love it. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. My question for you is this. There are obviously two deaths that get addressed in this book, one of your beautiful friend Caroline and one of your beautiful dog Clementine. Mm. And when I was reading it, I was wondering, it almost felt to me like it was harder to write about Clementine's death. I was dreading it as a reader because I thought, oh no, so much will be ended when that happens. And I wondered, as a writer, if you experienced that, and did you write it chronologically?
I did experience it. I don't know that it was harder to write about. It was probably more piercing because it was more recent. And I think you're right. I think that it closed a chapter that I did not want to close. And, in fact, I couldn't end the book for a long time for that reason. I knew I only had 10 or 15 pages left, and I would sit in a chair and think, I'm not going to write that yet. When I write it, it'll be over, and I could not bear to finish the book.
There is a scene in the book after Caroline's death when you are out walking with Clementine in the park, and two pit bulls attack Clementine. Describe what happened.
Oh, God.
It was terrifying.
I don't know if I can describe it without my heart racing even now. We both lived, obviously. There were two dogs who were off lead and should not have been, and my beautiful 8-year-old was very docile and standing next to me, and they came running at us across a field and knocked me down and went after her. It was her they were interested in, and attacked her and tore her up pretty well, and I walked into the fight and had no effect whatsoever, obviously, on these two dogs who, as my friend Peter later said, I said, I can't believe I couldn't protect her. And he said the only thing that would have protected her would have been a gun that day, because they were so completely, pit bulls are actually, their genetics are to be able to go after and take down other dogs. So we managed to get away from that, and my girl crossed four streets to make her way home, which was the most important thing.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. First, she ran off into the woods, mm-hmm. and you got on the phone, called friends. Someone called you back, and you thought, it's either good or horrible news. Mm-hmm. And she had managed to get back home.
Oh, I can still hear him saying, I've got her. And I completely collapsed because I knew she was okay.
Now, someone else wants to know, what happened to Lucille, mm-hmm. Caroline's dog?
Wonderful, Lucille. Lucille stayed with Morelli, who adored her and had been her...
Caroline's
husband. Boyfriend and then husband, and had been connected to Lucille from the day Caroline brought her home. So he was her other significant other. And he took Lucille, and she lived a very happy life with him until last summer. So she lived to be 14.
Oh, I'm glad. Here's an email from Emily in Bethesda, Maryland. She says, I recently read an upsetting article in the New York Times describing how teachers, schools, and camps have begun to discourage best friendships from forming. I've always had a best friend in my life. It's been unendingly enriched by these girls, now women. Do you think that the drawbacks of best friendships, exclusivity, overdependence, are enough to merit counseling against them?
Well, certainly not from my point of view. You know, I do not know well enough now. Somebody did say something to me recently about what they described as the codependency and some other quality, not exclusivity, of women's friendships. And I thought, God, they certainly weren't called that when I was a girl.
Hardly.
I mean, I remember all kinds of sins committed in the name of friendship from the time I was young, 6 or 7 or 8 years old on. But I don't know. I think that for me, the intimacy and the connectedness outweigh whatever dysfunctional new words are being given.
Of course, Margaret Atwood
has cat's eye.
Talk about destructive friendships. But that somehow presented itself as a ruthless formation of a gang of girls.
Lord of the Flies for girls.
Exactly.
Yes, it really was. And Caroline and I used to talk about that book. We would both cringe simultaneously.
At which? Cat's Eye.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Terrifying book.
Terrifying, and I think every girl it strikes a chord with.
Yeah.
Either because they were...
Or a woman.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
Everyone who was ever a girl. They were either the hero or the victim.
Absolutely.
Or the bystander.
Absolutely.
Or sometimes the mean one, yeah.
What about male friendships? What do you see happening there? I was telling you during the break that my husband enjoys friendships through me, but has very few men, mm-hmm. with whom he has any kind of intimate friendship.
You know, it's funny. Somebody recently told me that they thought that Caroline and I had a relatively gender-free friendship. And I think what they were referring to was the fact that we had a competition between us that we both actually enjoyed. And there were sports and dogs, and there were traditionally male-ish pursuits that we had. I don't think there was anything gender-free about it, because I don't think Well, now I'll go out on a limb and say this. I don't think men generally form the sort of intimate attachment that we had here, or rather, I think it's much more difficult for them for a lot of reasons. They're at least in the last couple of generations, are not encouraged to have that sort of emotional intimacy, at least verbalized. So I know a couple of men who've said they really envied the friendship that we had.
All right, to Indianapolis and to Mary. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning. What a wonderful program.
Good.
Ms. Caldwell, I was wanting to get your advice. I am just coming out of an abusive, very controlling marital relationship that I was in for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid to let others in my life. I love this friendship that you have had, and I think I can see how it made you a better person. I would like that also.
Well,
any advice on that?
I think congratulations on your ability to get out of a situation that's that hard and that long. And I think my guess is, I don't know, but my guess is part of how you might have gotten out of it is with the help of somebody, whether it was family or support groups. I tend to come from a tradition of having found my way out of alcoholism and other sorrows, that mostly we do that with other people. So if you're afraid to let people in, start slow. You know, all it takes is one step forward, whether it's a support group or a call to a therapist or a friend who you knew 15 years ago that you want to have coffee with. I tend to think that if we can do any escape in small increments is what counts.
Good luck to you, Mary. And to Montpelier, Ohio. Good morning, Lindsay.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
I have not read this book, but it sounds tremendously intriguing to me. I have had a short lifetime full of best friends, and I was wondering, can Gail tell us a bit more about the profound effect it must have had on her to see the end of her best friend's earthly life? And also, one more quick thing. Gail, did you ever notice Caroline's attitude change to accommodate her illness or her dismal diagnosis? I'm glad to take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Oh, God, just straight to the heart of the beast. Of course, Caroline had to change. It's like learning how to fly midair. She had to change in relation to the news that she had gotten, and I feel that because of our friendship, I still remember her calling me from the hospital one day when she had gone downstairs, and it was 8 a.m., and she'd just found out that week. And she didn't feel bad yet. She knew she had a terminal diagnosis, but she actually felt pretty good because they had her on antibiotics. And the phone rang at probably 7:45, and I said, "Are you okay?" I grabbed the phone and said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "Yes, I've run away. I'm thinking of going for a row." And Caroline was always hilariously funny, and she managed to be for all of her life. So I think that I will say seriously that my being able to be with her in the last weeks of her life was one of the hardest and best experiences of my life. And when I say best, I mean only that it was an honor to be able to do it.
You were there at the hospital?
Most of the time. I was there up until close to the end, and the last probably 17 days were simply that dark, long corridor of suffering that the dying often are in.
Gail Caldwell, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Would you read for us the portion regarding grief that we talked about earlier? I think it's page 154.
150, I believe. The only education in grief that any of us ever gets is a crash course. Until Caroline died, I had belonged to that other world, the place of innocence and linear expectations, where I thought grief was a simple, wrenching realm of sadness and longing that gradually receded. What that definition left out was the body blow that loss inflicts, as well as the temporary madness, and a range of less straightforward emotions shocking in their intensity. I would move as though I were underwater for weeks, maybe months, but those first few days between the death and the memorial service were a dazed cascade of tears and surprises. A part of me went through the appropriate motions with frightening alacrity, finding the poem to read at the chapel on Friday morning, practicing it aloud. But another part of me had the simple conviction that I wouldn't be able to get from point A to point B, that giving her over, in spirit and in public, was as perplexing and unfathomable as string theory. My old friend Pete, out of town when she died, called from Ohio to see how I was. I told him what I had been afraid to say. "I don't think I can do it," I said, about getting through the service the next day. "I don't know how to do it." He was quiet for a minute, and then he said something of such consolation that I will hear him saying it forever. "You know, Gail," he said, "we've been doing this as a species for a long time. And it's almost as if it's like the body just knows what to do."
And did you get through it?
Well, I'm here today. You know, we all get through, whether we think we can. The amazing thing to me is that we believe that we cannot, and then you look up and time has won out once again, and 5 minutes or 5 days have passed. So, you know, what was Dylan Thomas's great phrase, the green fuse that drives the flower? There is some need to keep going in spite of our terrors that we won't be able to.
And she's still with you.
Oh, wonderfully. You know, this is the thing that it takes a long time to realize. And I think that part of the joy for me, a friend of mine said, I'm so worried this is going to be wrenching for you to write this book. And I was beaming because I just made the decision to write it and had begun taking reams and reams of notes. And I said, "Are you kidding? I get to spend the next 2 years with her." And it was really true in a surprisingly continuing and joyous way.
Because you could hear her voice.
Absolutely. I still can.
Have you gotten yourself a new dog?
I do. I have a new dog who's not even new anymore. She's 2 years old, and she's as full of fire as any puppy anybody ever had.
What kind of a dog?
She's another Samoyed. You know, they say the definition of insanity is to do the same thing again. And so I'm back in the world of Sammy's, and her name is Tula, and she's 2 years old.
And you have a new best friend?
No, I still have the same best friend.
Gail Coldwell. Her new book is titled Let's Take the Long Way Home, A Memoir of Friendship. Beautiful book, Gail.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Saab, for people who have a different perspective on driving. Learn more at saabusa.com. Saab, move your mind. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Each week we ask one simple question, just one, about somewhere in the world. Today we're in England asking, how do you cook on an aga?
An aga is a cast iron stove.
This is my friend Jane Alexander, and she's promised me
a traditional English fry-up. Eggs, bacon, sausages, baked beans, tomatoes.
But here's the catch.
I think we're going to cook it the healthy way on the aga.
Jane's aga is green enamel.
At the bottom we have two cast iron doors. On the left-hand side is the burner, and on the right-hand side is there are two ovens.
One's for slow cooking and one's for roasting.
On top of the ovens is a cast iron enamel top with a simmering plate and a boiling plate.
They're oversized to fit multiple pots, and concave lids trap the heat until you lift them. Aga folks call these cooking zones. Interestingly, it has
no knobs, no switches, no on and off button, nothing.
The simple principle of heat rising guides most aga cooking. Jane explains.
So if you want to cook at a certain temperature, you would just put your pan or your dish further back if you wanted the heat, and further to the left for the heat. And if you wanted it cooler, you'd bring it lower down and further to the right. So our sausages are sizzling in the back here.
Wow, they're actually browning, and there's no liquid around them at all.
No, there's no fat on this at all.
Instead of oil, she uses Baker Glide. It's like parchment paper for the aga. In fact, she uses less than a tablespoon of oil for our entire breakfast.
You need very little fat when you're cooking on the aga. You'd get no smells in your kitchen if you cook in the oven. The aga is extracted up a chimney. The only way you know if you're burning food is if you go into your garden.
Sounds like she speaks from experience.
Oh yes, we've had sausages in there for 4 days.
The traditional English aga is hip again, but it was created in the 1920s in Sweden by a Nobel laureate named Gustav Dalén. Once agas heated houses and boiled water for washing too, but now they're mostly about the food.
So our last component for our English breakfast is our fried egg.
Jane puts a sheet of Baker Glide on the simmering plate.
We're just going to warm that up slightly and then...